Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. This weekend's show going to be very much focused on the resource sector and more of a half-year recap as we just turned the calendar over to July, a very broken-up trading week this last week with Canada Day on Tuesday, July 4th on Friday. I think that gives us a good time to take a look back, see what happened in these markets, especially in the resource sector, because we saw a lot of commodities, metals especially, outperform the broad U.S. averages. Now, yes, it was a wild ride. U.S. markets went through a pretty severe, pretty quick correction. It was shortly around and after Liberation Day. But look, U.S. markets, those are also back to all-time highs, but it's the commodities and a lot of the commodity stocks that outperform the markets, maybe a bigger picture shift of capital, maybe just a half-year trend. Who knows? But it gives us a chance to recap what we saw in the first 6 months of this year. We are kicking off this show with Joe Mazumdar. Joe is the editor of Exploration Insights. Very valuable newsletter for all of you resource investors out there looking at individual companies to allocate your money towards. Joe, let's start off with kind of your overview. What we saw in the first half of the year in the resource sector, what stood out to you, Joe?
Well, I guess what stood out to me and the market in general is, you know, the leverage provided by gold or precious metals equities. You know, they were the best performing asset class in terms of the ones I cover on a weekly basis for subscribers. They were up about 58% in the first half, which is a proxy's GDXJ, and that's because the gold price was up about 27% and the silver price was about 23%. And so that's one component. But the best performing metal that I have is basically platinum. Platinum cumulative deficits that have been going on for a while and people are forecasting will continue. And then also in China, the jewelers are also, you know, switching out from gold, which is much higher cost, to platinum with respect to jewelry, and that's adding even more tightness to the market, and hence the reason it's spiking. It's not just a catalytic converter demand. Some of that is said to be that, like, a drop in EV demand potentially in the States as well as in other regions, as having people building more internal combustion engines, which need the catalytic converters, which need platinum for diesel engines, and probably more so palladium for gasoline engines. But from what I understand, you know, platinum is, when it was a lower price, was moving into the palladium market as well. And then you've got uranium doing well, uranium equities as well. You know, they were up 30%. And overall, you know, because the S&P TSX Venture is made up of a lot of these juniors and non-cash flowing resource companies that in the first half of the year had outperformed the benchmark equities in the U.S.
Well, Joe, one metal that we didn't discuss there that's had a nice light shown on it is copper. As we record this midweek, it's around 520. You've seen some life, not just in the copper price and maybe some forward outlook on the economy, but we've even seen the producers, as referenced by COPEX, Blast Hire, and even the copper juniors, the developers and explorers, have been getting a bid, which we hadn't seen in a while. What's your take on the red metal?
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. Copper was up about 13% in the first half, but the base metal equity ETF that I follow was basically flat. The XBM was like 1%. And, you know, because base metals are made up of copper, but also zinc, and zinc was down 9% year to date. And so that's why equities were a bit flat overall. But, you know, the ones that are more exposed to copper, they've done pretty well in the copper market. On the cathode side, we know is tight, you know, and the actual forward curve is in backwardation, suggesting, I mean, the price at spot is higher than the forward price, trying to incentivize people with off exchange inventories to bring those in to the exchange, but still people aren't bringing it in, you know, because they want to have the actual copper cathode. And that's what people call the convenience yield. And that backwardation is evident on the cathode market. But then if we take a step back at the concentrate market, because most companies and mines produce concentrate, which goes to a smelter to produce cathode, the concentrate market, as we highlighted before in the call, is in negative territory. And so yeah, the treatment charges and the refining charges are what smelters charge companies for treating and refining their concentrate, which is a discount off of the copper price. But right now, because China has built up additional smelting capacity, and we've had projects like Cobre Panama go offline recently, Ivanhoe Mines had to change their guidance at one of the bigger mines in the world, which is Kamoa-Kakula, because of seismic activity that has impacted their water pumping abilities underground. That has all kept TCRCs negative, which is also, a positive for the copper market in terms of for producers. So yes, definitely copper has been well served in the current environment. And, an add-on would be potential tariffs on copper cathodes coming into the US, which would give an advantage for people producing or potentially producing in the US. Ivanhoe Electric put out their pre-feasibility study for Santa Cruz, which is an underground copper project, leaching oxides and chalcocite, a copper sulfide that's amenable to the solvent extraction, and leaching it there to produce a copper cathode. So all of this is good, and I've been buoyant, bullish about the copper market for a while, and I continue to be so.
So, Joe, it seemed like the first half of this year, Q1, gold was doing really well, and gold even did well in Q2, but it seemed like there was a bit of a catch-up trade from some of the other metals in Q2 of this year. That's all taking out that noise from the very start of the quarter in April when we had Liberation Day and everything fell and everything rebounded quickly. Are the markets right now, considering gold has, for the most part, traded in a fairly tight trading range for the last about 2.5 months, are we seeing a catch-up trade in a lot of these other metals and commodities outside of even precious metals that are catching up to the really impressive moves gold has had over the last year now?
Yeah, for me, the gold market is impacted by different things than each individual market that we're talking about, whether it's, and copper has its own underlying themes. We got into like a potentially a rebound in nickel, which has its own themes. And there might be sort of a trickle-down impact by investors in the resource sector that are now looking. Gold has brought them in and opened the door, and now they're looking at other metals, especially, the ones that are either critical or, let's say, security minerals that China's looking to ban the exports of, like we've seen for antimony and rare earths and things like that. So yeah, there could be that as well. But gold, what we're seeing is that in the first quarter to April or May, around that time, the first 3 to 4 months of the year, we saw a lot of inflow in gold ETFs, especially from the North American funds buying gold equity ETFs. And so those gold, sorry, not equity ETFs, gold ETFs, that tends to, trickle down into gold equities, and that's why, gold equities did quite well. That switched a little bit after Liberation Day. And now we're seeing a little bit more inflows, and probably the idea of, this big, beautiful bill coming in and potentially adding more trillions to the US deficit over the next decade, and potentially a new Fed chairman that would do the US administration's bidding and cut rates rather than keep them stable or raise them. It would be probably maintain people's bullishness for the precious metal.
Well, and Joe, when we think about the gold equities and we think about the earnings potential as these prices keep moving higher, their costs aren't moving up to the same degree that the price has. So the price has outstripped the cost. And so you're seeing margins widen. Some of the widest margins we've ever seen. There's companies out there with 1500, even upwards of $2,000 margins right now. And we saw Q4 of last year better than Q3, Q1 of this year better than Q4. We just finished Q2. We don't have the numbers out yet, but most people are expecting record revenues, because of these wide margins. Do you think that's all priced in at this point, or could that actually surprise maybe some of the generalists that don't follow the space as closely, and maybe they get shocked by the earnings potential of the sector?
Well, I mean, what I had seen for the first quarter versus the previous quarter was there was actually what happens in the fourth quarter of any given year is people tend to ramp up their production. They ramp up their production because they're interested in meeting guidance, and the ability to meet guidance is important for them. And so they will squeeze production in most of their assets to make sure they make guidance. And so that Q4 is usually tends to be the biggest quarter of quarterly production. And then there's usually a drop off in Q1. So quarter on quarter, there's usually a drop off from Q1 to Q4. This year, the Q1 production was a bigger quarter on quarter decrease than normal. So there was like a 14% decrease in quarter on quarter production, according to Ron Stewart of Red Cloud Securities, which he took off of 10 senior and 19 intermediate North American listed precious metal producers. So that's suggesting there was a bit of an issue in Q1. But their costs, like you said, had gone up, but they're obviously not going up as high as gold. But their costs have gone up 3 to 4% for senior producers, but they've gone up more for intermediate producers, like 12 to 13%, so to around 60 to 80 per ounce. And so those sort of trends are what people are going to watch in Q2. Does production stay steady? Does it fall? What do costs do? A lot of the tariff talk hasn't totally been implemented, so I don't see people getting impacted by that yet. But I'd like to see what that does impact for people with not only their sustaining capital, but also potentially their, people that are building projects. How do tariffs impact those estimates that they're looking at going forward? But right now, as you point out, still the precious metals increase in prices has probably more than offset the increase in costs so far.
So what about how the market's looking at it? We have finally started to see some of those inflows into equity ETFs. We even have Newmont, which we kind of have to use as a barometer for the at least gold sector. That's actually done pretty well and is at, I think, 52-week highs, at least very recently. Is the market in for a bit of a, I guess, shock when it comes to these earnings reports that could cause a further boost for the sector?
Well, I mean, last week, I think we saw, I was talking to somebody else, I mean, Agnico went down like 5% on one day. So we are seeing volatility, and part of that volatility last week was the on again, off again, geopolitical crisis between Israel and Iran, which might have pulled in the US. And so that was taken off, and so gold suffered a bit. I think the long-term thesis for gold is still positive. And I think, for any drop-off that we see in the gold price or in gold equities or ETFs is we need to see, I think we should be able to see people investing in the high quality plays. And that would be somebody like Agnico, that might be somebody like Alamos. They had issues in Q1, but they have the potential to rebound. So the quality companies, those ones, if there's any kind of pullback, those are the ones you want to get because I think the fundamentals for gold remain bullish, especially if, the US continues to increase its deficit and they're pushing for a new Fed chair that may cut rates as opposed to raise or hold them.
Well, Joe, if we filter down from the producers and get down into some of the juniors, the developers and explorers, let's start with the developers first. A lot of them still are trading at ounces in the ground for, let's just say, $20 to $60 an ounce. And obviously, with these record margins the producers have, just two questions embedded in one here. Why aren't we seeing more M&A where they could actually buy ounces cheaper than they could explore for them? And do you think there's a catch-up trade coming in these developers where they should get maybe a better valuation on their economic studies based on where metals prices have been trending this year?
Yes. So What we've seen, and so in terms of proxy for a healthy market, it's not only returns on the equity, but we want to see the financings kick up and we want to see more M&A. And so what we've seen on the financings, that is up according to the S&P Global Market Intelligence for the first 5 months of this year versus the first 5 months of last year. They're up about 20%, like 19% year on year. The number of transactions were flat. That which means that the value of each transaction was up about the same percent, maybe 17 or 18%. Most of the transactions were from Canada on the TSX and TSX Venture, number one source of financing, also had the largest growth. But most of the money went into gold. So gold companies, or people that call themselves gold companies, saw the biggest funding increase. So of the $4.7 billion raised through all the exchanges and that, $2.6 billion of that was just gold. Base metals were actually down. So most of what we're seeing in terms of drilling projects and things like that, the news flow is coming from gold companies, less so base metal companies. So, there is a catch up to be had there, I think, especially probably for the copper projects and that. In terms of M&A, the M&A last year was probably held back a bit for developers because most people want production. They're willing to pay up for production because you don't take the capital escalation risk, you don't take any permitting risk or development risk. So you're just straight into production. And a lot of that production was coming off of Newmont's divestments. Now that's behind us, I'm thinking that we should see more M&A going to single asset producers and potentially single asset developers. So what was interesting to me, as well as we saw some intermediate producers that where they can show more growth, and some of them that have done quite well, like Dundee Precious Metals, that's been an outperformer. They actually went for a base metal deposit, a polymetallic base metal deposit in their neck of the woods, which is Eastern Europe. They bought, they're proposing to take out Adriatic Metals, ASX listed. Another company, Harmony Gold, which has got obviously South African based, but they have exposure to Australia. They bought a copper producer, which is called Mac Copper in Eastern Australia. And so it's interesting to me that these companies are still keen on production. They're having a hard time potentially of finding, predominantly gold producing projects, but they're filling their pipeline with base metals, which they're, using as on an equivalent basis. Their gold production's going up, but they're truly a base metal project. So, that's probably the competition here as well for single asset developing gold projects is there might be some more production out there from single asset base metal producers that some of these intermediates lean to that are willing to take on some of copper, some, whatever zinc or whatever lead with some silver credit, those kind of projects. So there's a bit of a mix going on because, Mexico is problematic still for precious metals and a big silver producer. We've seen a lot of M&A there with Gatto Silver, Silvercrest being acquired, and now more recently MAG Silver being acquired. But most of that M&A has been from companies already operating in the country. We haven't seen a lot of people come from outside in. So for people looking for precious metals and silver exposure, they might be looking outside of Mexico. And so that's where I'm looking as well to other places. And Peru's another good producer of silver, but the problem with it is it's having problems with informal miners, which I saw earlier this year when I was there. And so more of my silver exposure now is in Chile and in Argentina right now, trying to look for projects outside of that risk profile.
Yeah, I'm curious if you've done any research on this. The fact that, look, the last bull market, everyone got mad at the majors because they were just acquiring all these ounces in the ground at the what was at the time elevated gold prices. And then 5 years later, when they might have thought about building those projects, the gold price was in a different position and they didn't want to build those gold projects. Now they've even offloaded some of them. Are the majors, at least in the gold space, which you are right, have looked to other metals outside of gold? Do they have a pipeline, or how big of a pipeline do they have of projects in that development pipeline? So is that why they might not be looking at these ounces in the ground? Because while the gold price is strong now, we don't know where it's going to be in 5 or 10 years when these projects could come into the development timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are like, if we're talking about, there's a difference between majors. I mean, some of these majors that produce, let's say, 3 to 4 million ounces per year, their ability to show a material impact on production lessens as they try to grow. You know, they get to an apex of their growth rate, and it's harder to find an asset that actually makes any difference. So most of them are basically running to stand still, and have switched to the idea of trying to attract generalist investors that want dividends. So they've sort of, you know, emphasized that part of their model, that, hey, I offer dividends, so buy me because I'm liquid, I've got portfolio diversification, I've got gold exposure, but unlike the gold equity ETF, I give you a dividend. So that's basically their thesis. Though the intermediates can show growth. And so if they acquire or discover, they can make a material impact on their bottom line with respect to growth of production. And so when I'm looking at growth in M&A right now, I'm looking more at the intermediates, because they have the paper and some of them have the treasury to actually start, you know, accruing these assets into their pipeline. I would say for other companies, again, it's harder. But you know, we're seeing the attraction now. I mean, we saw a little of this capital blowouts for these big open pit projects in Ontario, but some, you know, they might be coming back into vogue. You know, an example would be of what you know, Discovery Silver. They have a low-grade marginal open pit, you know, project in Mexico that they were getting nothing for. They basically got out of that and, you know, bought one of, you know, Newmont's divested development projects. And yeah, they've totally turned around their story to becoming a story about an open pit, you know, gram sort of deposit, gold deposit in Northern Ontario in the Timmins area, which is more amenable to current management, which, you know, like Tony Makuch, who's from that area. So there are different things happening with respect to trying to feed this pipeline and who can do what. But the other problem, or the other thematic we have an issue with, all the consolidation we've seen over the last decade, there's less suitors out there. There's not a lot of people in, like, in terms of demand, because there's less companies, and the mega companies are having a hard time acquiring projects that actually make a material impact. They have to acquire other companies to do that.
Well, Joe, I think that's an interesting point that there's less seniors, but there are still a couple dozen of the mid-tier to small producers that could still bolt on some of these development projects. I guess my question is, you know, when you think back to the last cycle in 2010 and 2011, yes, a lot of companies were overpaying for ounces, but they were paying $300 to $400 an ounce in the ground back then, or more in some cases. Some went up to $500 to $600 an ounce in the ground by 2011, and that was with gold at 1923 and margins for companies around 650. We're now looking at 1500 to 2000 margins again. I mean, maybe those will compress, but the gold price is far higher now, and yet these developers are still, again, only getting sub 100. A lot of them are 30, 40, 50, $60 an ounce in the ground. What does that mean for development stage companies? Why should companies go out and drill for more gold ounces if the ones that have already found it and delineated these deposits aren't getting fair value for them?
Yeah, I think some of the concern is permitting timelines. Like, if I buy that ounce, you know, I won't see that ounce for 10 to 15 years. I mean, some parts of the states and that, they're trying to accelerate that, and which would make development plays probably a little bit more attractive, especially though, because, you know, most companies are lazy. You know, when they buy a development project, they want the permitting behind them. They want the feasibility study or a definitive feasibility study done with a consulting group that they use, such that they trust the numbers. in a project that they infrastructure you think that they could work in and jurisdictionally works for them as well. So they get very picky about what works for them and what doesn't work for them. And then because we've got less suitors, we've got less people that, oh, hey, that could play a tuba versus a clarinet versus whatever instruments out there. Some places, I don't know how to play a guitar, so I'm not going to buy a guitar. So there's less of those people up. There's not two or three people out there or four or five companies out there that know how to play a guitar and will bid on that said guitar. We don't have that kind of liquidity on the M&A side just because of the consolidation. And then you have that other layer of being very picky and asking about, that I don't want to buy a project with a permitting issue because, I'm not bringing anything to the table. It still might take 10 years to build it. I want a material impact within the next 5 years of my CEO tenure, let's say. I'm not buying something for the next CEO of the company. That's not part of my, KPI. So yeah, these people want to bring a material impact, and that usually comes from production. So we've seen a lot of these producing assets get acquired, but some of them are still overvalued. So if you look at some of these single asset producers, some of them have a high price tag and people aren't willing to acquire them. So then to your point, do they move to the next stage of development? I think yes, but they're going to move to the next stage of development where the company's got infrastructure, the company's got the permitting handled, they've got water access, power and all this other stuff, and they're well on their way to development, and potentially the company can see a clear path to getting this project within production within the next 2 to 3 years. That's, I think, the next level of M&A, whether it be in copper, gold, silver, or any of these other metals that see these kind of market dynamics.
Hey, for some of these mid-tiers too, just let them build up some cash. Give them a little bit more time so that they do have that war chest to make some of these bigger acquisitions. Maybe that'll help as well. Joe, let's go down to the juniors then. The drillers, the explorers, they have raised a lot of money just in the last month or so. Man, oh man, the floodgates have really opened. I've been on record saying this is one of the best environments I've seen outside a couple short-term spurts where juniors are raising money and now they are going out and drilling. What are you seeing? I guess we can call it more down at the bottom of the food chain in the resource sector, whether it's gold, copper, really a lot of the different metals. The juniors have cash now and they're out drilling.
Yes. So if we take that same time period to the end of May, the total number of projects that were drilled for the first 5 months of the year, basically flat, same number of projects, but the number of gold projects was actually up 19%. What was down were people looking at specialty minerals like lithium, and that as that market has compressed, and that's one of the worst performing commodities was lithium carbonate equivalent, that's gone away. And what's taken its place to offset that loss has been gold. And the number of drill holes drilled within that period, slightly up 6%, over 20,152 holes drilled over the first 5 months that the S&P Global Market Intelligence recorded. But both gold and base metals, and I would say probably mostly copper, are up 10 to 13% in terms of the number of drill holes. And that was dragged down a bit by, again, these specialty mineral projects. It was down by 23%. So that money that we were talking about, that the more money going to the juniors and non-cash flowing companies, that money has been translated to more drilling, mostly for gold and base metals. And so most of the companies I look forward to in the portfolio have raised the money, and most of the money they've raised is, 12 to 24 months worth of money, and, significant drill programs, either. And most retail investors and people like that are interested in growth, so they're interested in more of the resource plays here. And they're definitely getting people that generate decent results, definitely get rewarded, in the current market. There's not anybody waiting for a liquidity play to dump right now on good news. They're definitely getting rewarded.
Joe, this is probably a question you've heard many times, and we've asked it many times, but I keep thinking about it as I was listening to you talking. Probably over 1,000 companies that are drill plays, that are, earlier stage explorers, and all that capital that's raised that we just saw raised is going to need more capital again next year, we know, and maybe even in 6 months. And that's the hamster wheel where they drill, they hope they get market love, and they raise more money. Now, maybe we can get into that good cycle where they keep raising at a higher level, but are there just too many exploration companies fighting for the market's attention to really see, the cream rise to the top? There's a few that have been rewarded, but so many that are stagnant still.
Yes, and hopefully stagnant for a good reason, because they lack, let's say, the technical expertise. Jurisdictionally, they might be in the wrong spot, or their costs are very high for where they are. And so that's something else I look for is bang for buck in terms of drilling costs. So the markets, as we know, are finicky. Financing could be great one quarter and then bad the next. So you want to be able to invest in companies for bang for buck. They can do more with the money they have, and they're looking for the right commodities. Those are very important things to think about, and would probably be able to excise a lot of the wheat from the chaff in this market. So I put a lot of emphasis on the people, obviously, not only from a technical side, which is very important, but also from a capital access side, and knowing how to change their, allocate their capital depending on where the market is, because they have to raise money. And so if you're raising money for a commodity or in a jurisdiction that the market doesn't want to fund, you're going to have to change, unless you have this, unless you're funded by some kind of money, which is another positive that I look for, is long-term money in a junior that could ride out the issues with the retail market. And so you need some of these long-term investors that will support the company no matter what. And it's usually the people that have the technical ability, access to capital, got the right projects in the right jurisdiction, right commodity exposure that attract these types of funds. And so it's sort of, one feeds off of the other, and that makes it easier for me to recommend or to buy into these companies. And there is 1,000 or whatever plus companies out there, but just looking at the people, I could sift a lot of those pretty easy.
Yeah, as much as we want the generalists to come in, you are right. We do have kind of the diehard investors in those funds that have started, I think, to see a little bit of inflows, at least not the outflows that they were seeing to support longer term these projects. But hey, Joe, any areas, jurisdictions that you see just as simply more interesting right now or just has better action in it for investors?
Yes. So, I think Argentina, if you got the right province in Argentina, the current government is really pushing, and I think we've talked about this before. And Salta was always a great province. I used to work there in northwest Argentina. So that's a place that I'm very positive on. I think Chile is turning around. They're going to have an election coming up. Their left-wing government is even making permitting easier now, because they know they're going to lose the election, but they're making permitting easier. And so I think Chile's going to rebound. And I've got exposure to that part. I have exposure, limited exposure to Peru. My concern in Peru is not on the permitting side, but mostly for higher grade deposits that might be, and this could be a higher grade copper, silver, and gold, that these illegal miners are starting to make inroads. Not starting, they've been doing it for 10 years. That's become a big issue in Peru. I saw that when I was there earlier this year. I saw it when I was there late last year, and it's just getting worse. There's going to be an election in Peru. I think this is solvable, but you really need, a little bit of political force to do it. My exposure to Mexico is limited, and everything the current government, which is an extension of AMLO from a year ago, is suggesting that exploration in Mexico is not a thing. And that even though they're not saying, to ban open pits, they're being very coy with how they advance anybody that wants to build an open pit. So I'm not overly exposed to Mexico. I like the US if you got the right state, because I think the federal government is much more positive on permitting. But if you're in a state which has very strong permitting laws like water issues or something like that, you're still, the federal government can't change that. So you got to be nuanced there. So yeah, I think there's a lot of nuances right now in terms of permitting with new governments coming in that, could impact the juniors and especially developers as well.
Well, Joe, just one more observation. With the rise in platinum over the last really few weeks, we've had a lot of questions coming in about how to play platinum and, and PGM type deposits. And it really kind of brings in a broader discussion on, we've talked a little bit off mic about nickel, and a lot of the nickel deposits have PGMs as a co-credit, and also copper. Copper doing so well, tying into nickel and PGM. So when you tie all those metals together, copper, platinum, palladium, and nickel, are there opportunities in nickel companies that could be ways to play platinum and copper? Are there copper companies where you can play nickel and palladium and platinum? What's your thoughts on tying those polymetallic deposits together?
Yeah, so polymetallic deposits have, and people try to do this with their, either nickel equivalent, copper equivalent, then they throw everything in. Metallurgy is very important for polymetallic. So when you get one of these deposits, you got to really understand, the metallurgy and whether you can actually generate any revenue from these byproducts. Because some of these guys will say, okay, we're going to produce this concentrate and that concentrate, but then you look and they don't even recover the byproducts. They might not get the PGEs, they might not get the gold. They might. So that's an important thing, a caveat to look at once you're considering this. But so I am looking, because I do think that there's a potential for the nickel market to rebound, because Indonesia has oversupplied the market. We've seen BHP and some other companies take low grade, high cost production like in Western Australia offline. So that's no longer impacting the market. So, that takes a little bit of a while to get through the market. And now we've seen BHP go in and make an investment in a nickel project in Tanzania. So I think if you can find a base metal project with that's polymetallic, that's, can lower their cost through the byproduct or co-product credits, you're in the right, area for development in terms of jurisdiction. I think there's windows there of taking advantage of that. And then that's definitely what I'm doing with my last round of site visits. I have been looking at those sort of projects.
All right, Joe, we'll wrap it up here. Interesting to recap this first half of the year. And hey, a lot of opportunities in the resource sector with a lot of these underlying equities also doing very well and outperforming the broad averages. Let's hope that just carries through to the second half of this year in a prolonged bull market, because right now it's been good times for resource and commodity investors for the last year plus, and it's been different spurts of commodities doing well. But at the tail end of the first half of this year, we really saw all these other resources and commodities play catch up with the underlying stocks, and that money filter down into the juniors. Again, Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Click the link in the show notes to sign up for Joe's newsletter and follow along with the companies, the sites he's visiting, and the companies he's writing up. Joe, thank you so much for your time on this weekend show.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.